Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 14th day of April 2020. It's a Tuesday, in case you lost track. It's, I don't know, day 30 or something of isolation, whatever it is. I'm sitting here with Quinn Hunter, who has an important message to tell the world. Alright, that's not exactly what we rehearsed, but well done. So, Quinn, do you want to embarrass yourself when you're a teenager and tell the world that you're learning to use the potty?
No, we're just on inside Paw Patrol.
Oh, you think you're here to talk about Paw Patrol? Okay, who's your favorite Paw Patrol pup?
I don't have Paw Patrol toy to get fill out a plane.
All right. Well, thank you for stopping by, Quinn. Good job.
Good job, too.
Oh, thank you. Say goodbye to everybody.
Bye-bye.
There you go. Quinn, and well, she's learning to use the potty, and she just did, and was rewarded with a piece of chocolate. And now she wants more chocolate. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host and child wrangler, as well as a housebreaker. I have broken many an animal, and now I'm on to my first biped, as far as potty training goes. So far, so good. Action-packed program, as usual, as President Trump just literally bitch-slapped the media today. I could just play the whole damn thing. It was amazing, but I won't. I do want to focus on one particular aspect of it, and that is the desperate attempt by the media, and by that I mean the Democratic Party, to try and get Anthony Fauci fired. They think that they can get Anthony Fauci fired. It's comical. It'd be funnier if lives weren't at stake, if they weren't ignoring real substantive health issues in order to score cheap political points.
It's on Sonic Kristoff.
Yes, Kristoff from Frozen. Okay, go watch your Paw Patrol. They're really desperate to try and get Anthony Fauci fired. Oh, yes, you're dressed up as Anna. Do you think Dr. Fauci should be fired, Quinn?
Nope, I'm Anna.
All right, well, that's not exactly the greatest rationale for it, but hey, you've done it. Now you're Elsa. Okay. Sorry. That God's given me a chance to talk about our great sponsor today, Life Change Tea. You go to getthetea.com. You pick up your flavor, pick out your flavor. It makes you regular. It's the tea that makes you go. Lord knows we could use that. And you got to put all that toilet paper you hoarded to good use. And important part of it is it cleans you out and allows you to digest more of the nutrition from the food that you are already eating. You go to getthetea.com. Choose your great choice, your great flavor. You brew up a gallon of it. It brews up a ton of it. And then you put it in the fridge. Just drink about a cup a day, just a regular old glass a day. Follow the instructions. Don't overdo it. And you'll find that you have more energy because you are able to absorb more of the nutrition in your food, which is why you eat food in the first place, or why your body needs food. You probably eat it because it tastes good. And at checkout, you enter promo code Derek, my name, D-E-R-E-K. You get free fast shipping. You can't beat it. Great sale prices on a great product and free fast shipping. Done and done. You support the show. You support me. It supports you. The circle of life goes on. Okay, let's talk about this press conference. By the way, we have a great interview, really great interview. We have a guy who is a friend of mine who happens to have been Dick Cheney's top policy advisor while he was vice president of the United States. He also happens to be the publisher and co-founder of the Daily Caller, Neil Patel. Smart guy, fun guy, hard boss. But a bit of a hard ass. Now, he's soft on the inside. It's just that you can't get in there. You'll enjoy it. And it's not often. He doesn't do much media. He should, but he doesn't. And we pick his brain for a good 40 minutes. So it's well worth it because there are some parallels. And he, Lord knows, when you're working in the White House during 9/11 and you're Dick Cheney's top advisor, you have been through some stuff. And we draw on all of his experience. So you don't want to miss that. Plus, we have a little fun at his expense because, frankly, he deserves it. But before we get to that, I want to talk about this Fauci interview. I have a couple of clips of Fauci that I want to play that because you would think that Anthony Fauci is just on the verge of sainthood. Nothing against the guy, but he is not the president of the United States. I went back and looked up the ballot in 2016, and I scoured it. I could not find Anthony Fauci, or any Fauci for that matter, on the ballot for president of the United States in 2016. I looked in multiple states. So the way the media talks about him is as if he should be president of the United States. The president should defer to him. The only thing that matters is what Anthony Fauci says. Listen to the experts. Will you listen to the doctors? Will you promise to listen to the doctors? Every press conference where the discussion comes around to whether or not our economy will be able to exist anymore is always littered with questions about, will you listen to Dr. Fauci? Will you listen to the experts? Will you listen to the medical experts? Yes, of course. I listen to them all the time. And they listed many instances in which the president of the United States listened to the medical experts. But the president of the United States is not simply the presidential puppet of medical experts. He has multiple considerations, and sometimes being a leader is being forced to make a decision, make a choice between no good options, no perfect options. Certainly, most choices made by real leaders is a choice between least bad options. Sometimes, every once in a while, you get a good one. And sometimes what seems like a bad idea does work out. It's just not the norm, no matter what, especially if you're a Republican. No matter what decision you make, there are going to be people who are negatively impacted by it. That's just a fact of life. A nation of 330 million people does not conform with a spandex decision. One size does not fit all. I guarantee you that whenever the government, the federal government, in conjunction with the states, since that's where the real power to do this lies, starts reopening segments of the economy, there will be people who are diagnosed with coronavirus after that, and possibly as a result of that. We have to know that going in. We do know that going in. People do know that going in. The challenge, if you will, is that so many people in our media will be cheering for those bad consequences. Moreover, they will be highlighting them. I've said this a lot because it's absolutely relevant to things like health policy, is the Democrats and the media, but I repeat myself, will find the worst case scenario and present it as the norm. That's what they do. That's where they live. As such, deaths that happen that can be attributed to the restarting of the economy, any sort of economic activity, any encouragement of the lifting of stay-at-home orders or social media, even though social distancing, not social media, that probably kills a lot of people, but social distancing will be highlighted as if Donald Trump shoved some sweet, nourishing, innocent, unsuspecting person into a bucket of coronavirus. That's how it will be reported, because that's what they're waiting for. That's what they're sexually aroused at the prospect of. The human potato over at CNN, Brian Stelter, I can picture him rubbing his nipples with Crisco right now, thinking soon, my precious, someone will die, and I can directly attribute that to Donald Trump. But that's a trade-off and a decision leaders have to make. They have to. When we're facing millions of deaths or hundreds of thousands of deaths, the president had a call to make. He made the call to save the lives. If you're facing dozens of deaths versus the ruination of the economy and millions of American families and businesses, you don't get to pick, you don't do it in that sense. You have to go, we have to make this decision. That's what the president's job is. Anthony Fauci is to give advice on a medical, from a medical perspective, but the economists are to be heard. The psychologists who will tell you, if you ask, and the media isn't asking because it doesn't help their cause, that the economic destruction will bring about massive destructions of American families, of American lives, and will lead to an increase in suicides. They don't care about that. That can't be blamed on Donald Trump. Too many Democrats have their fingerprints on it. So they'll find somebody who contracts coronavirus and dies of it. Probably somebody in every state as they start reopening and say, well, you know, this death didn't have to happen. They'll find some grieving parent just like they do at any tragedy. They ignore the half of the participants who don't want to ban guns forever. Half of the victims, I don't want to ban guns. I want to be able to protect myself. And they'll highlight only the David Boss Hogs of the world. That's how it is. The other half of Marion Stoneman Douglas School might as well not exist. Actually, any other student might as well not exist. It's just David Hogg. He was the one kid who went to that school, if you just watched CNN. That's all they care about. They will do the same. If 100 people die after the loosening of restrictions and the encouraging of economic activity, they will find as many of them as they can who they can get on camera cursing Donald Trump, their family members. They will, immediately. Then they'll pick the most photogenic, the most articulate, and the angriest. Wherever those three points intersect, well, wherever they form a line, since three points form a line. Well, actually, 2 points form a line. But wherever they intersect, they will highlight that person and essentially give them a show. They will be treated like Michael Avenatti was treated before he went to jail for being a complete scumbag. That's how this game works. So with that in mind, you want the best experts in the room advising the president of the United States, and you want them from every field because you have to weigh the pros and cons. It sounds very cold to sit there and say you're talking about human lives and you've got to weigh pros and cons, but that's the way the world works. And if you knew every single decision, one of the things Neil talks about, you'll hear him talk about the speed limit. It's an excellent point. I had never thought of it in the context that he put it. But we do make a compromise on the speed limit between efficiency and convenience and human lives. You have to make that decision. It's an awful decision. It's an awful it's not an awful decision. It's an awful position to be put in. But that's the position leaders seek. So when it happens, you know that it will be a tough decision for the president to have made. The media will treat it as cavalierly as changing their pants after they wet themselves when they think they saw Barack Obama in a crowd. With that in mind, they're trying to drive a wedge between Anthony Fauci and the president of the United States. On Sunday, Jake Tapper had on Fauci, and he asked him a completely and totally irrelevant question. Of course, it's CNN, so that's where they live. The question was, if we'd acted sooner, could we have saved lives? Now, it's a stupid question for many reasons. It's a hypothetical in the past. It's not even trying to predict future behavior or, you know, get information about which way somebody who's going to make a decision could be leaning something yet to come. It is hindsight. It's also dumb in that obviously if you'd never opened up if the Wright brothers had never taken off at Kitty Hawk in 1903, there would be no airplanes. And then coronavirus would have had to have traveled here via ship. And while the ship was en route, the outbreak would have occurred. Therefore, we could have prevented the ship from ever docking and thereby avoiding the entire coronavirus outbreak, right? Yeah, logically, that makes sense. But we don't have a time machine. We can't go beat up Orville and Wilbur and tell them that people is meant to be on the ground. Stop it. You're killing people 120 years later or whatever the hell it is. So looking back at what we could have done, while also conveniently ignoring what was done, is not to elicit information for the audience. It is to drive a wedge between two people who are pretty crucial in this fight. It's also to throw some red meat to the left, and boy howdy did they. Every newspaper on the planet had a story about Fauci says if Trump had acted sooner, lives could have been saved. It's not exactly what he says, but it wasn't a response to a stupid hypothetical question. Listen to it for yourself. I told you what Jake Tapper's question was. Here's Dr. Fauci's answer.
You know, Jake, again, it's the what would have, what could have. It's very difficult to go back and say that. I mean, obviously, you could logically say that if you had a process that was ongoing and you started mitigation earlier, you could have saved lives. Obviously, no one is going to deny that. But what goes into those kinds of decisions is complicated. But you're right. I mean, obviously, if we had right from the very beginning shut everything down, it may have been a little bit different. But there was a lot of pushback about shutting things down.
Now, the press seized on the part there is saying there's a lot of pushback on shutting things down. Oh, like, oh, that, you mean the Trump administration must have been pushing back. They didn't want to shut things down back before there was any kind of problem, right? Yeah, shut things down prematurely. You know, they shut things down in January with travel to China, and the left and the media started calling the president a racist. In fact, back in February, Dr. Fauci himself didn't really seem to think that there was a necessity to shut things down. Here he was talking on the Today Show on Saturday. I believe it's February 29th. I could be wrong about the date. But needless to say, this was before the before Fauci had changed his tune.
So, Dr. Fauci, it's Saturday morning in America. People are waking up right now with real concerns about this. They want to go to malls and movies, maybe the gym as well. Should we be changing our habits? And if so, how?
No, right now, at this moment, there is no need to change anything that you're doing on a day-by-day basis. Right now, the risk is still low, but this could change. I've said that many times, even on this program. You've got to watch out because although the risk is low now, you don't need to change anything you're doing. When you start to see community spread, this could change and force you to become much more attentive to doing things that would protect you from spread.
Now, that was February 29th, Saturday, leap day. Certainly not sounding the alarm that we should shut things down. We need to destroy our economy. We need to get people to shelter in place. In fact, he's saying, no, you don't really have to worry about it right now. If we start seeing stuff, you know, feces hitting the fan from there on out, then we can talk about it. That's all conveniently memory-holed, and Anthony Fauci is now an infallible human being. So that's a huge, huge change. Well, Anthony Fauci is only infallible when he is pitted against Donald Trump. When he backs up what the president has said, anytime, he is then, you know, are you being threatened? Are you being silenced? Are you okay? Blink twice if you need us to rescue you. Jim Acosta is at the ready with a go bag by the door, just in case there's an opening to get you out of there, Anthony Fauci. Let us know. It's weird. His word is to be taken as if it were carved into stone tablets by a burning bush if he is in any way, shape, or form says something that can be interpreted as differing from the President of the United States. But if he gives praise to the President of the United States for his decisions, well, then it's obvious that the President is applying pressure to him in order to try and boost his own fragile ego. That brings us to today, when Fauci came out because his words on Jake Tapper's show about a ridiculous, retroactive, hypothetical situation, that the answer is obvious. And Jake Tapper, my daughter, would know that, yes, well, if you could go back in time and stop anybody from China from ever coming here, then certainly you certainly would have been able to stop the spread of coronavirus. But you can't do that. So what's the point in that question except for to try and drive a wedge between the president and the infectious disease specialist? Fauci wanted to address this yesterday at the press briefing, which he did, which was immediately met with questions of, were you forced to do this? Did you do this? Jim Acosta's go bag is ready to go. Here's Fauci.
The travel was another recommendation when we went in and said we probably should be doing that. And the answer was yes. And then another time was we should do it with Europe. And the answer was yes. And the next time we should do it with the UK. And the answer was yes.
In this interview, you said there was pushback.
Yeah.
Where did that pushback come from?
No, it wasn't. And that was the wrong choice of words. You know what it was? When people discuss, not necessarily in front of the president, when people discuss, they say, well, you know, this is going to have maybe a harmful effect on this or on that. So it was a poor choice of words. There wasn't anybody saying, no, you shouldn't do that.
Upon hearing the most trusted man in Washington, the most honorable man in Washington, say that and deny everything that the media had spun out his words out of context, Paula Reed from CBS News, such an idiot, goes back at the most honorable man on the face of the earth and says, are you saying this voluntarily or are you lying? Are you being pressured to lie? We've got Jim Acosta's go bag. Should we get you out of here, Mr. Fauci? And he's having none of it.
Are you doing this voluntarily or did
no,
the president...
No, I'm doing it. Everything I do is voluntarily. Please, don't even imply that.
That's just this side of a bitch, please. Did you not hear me? Shut the F up and get the F out of here. But, of course, this is CBS News. Such a stupid question against somebody who just a few hours ago was their god is still be rewarded. She'll likely be on the CBS morning show tomorrow recounting her confrontation with the president and Dr. Fauci. And she'll wildly speculate as to why I believe somebody talked to Fauci and said he needs to pull back on this because why else would he do that? He couldn't possibly be telling the truth because our media is scum and they deserve every bad thing that happens to them. That is all the time we have for this. We got the interview next with Neil Patel. You will like it. You will learn from it. You will laugh. You'll gain insights into the behind the scenes of the Daily Caller as well as behind the scenes of working in the White House. It's fun and fascinating. We'll be back here tomorrow with another exciting episode. Here's Neil Patel. All right, as we've been doing throughout this, we check in with people around the country, and sooner or later we'll do around the world to find out how they're dealing with it and get their perspectives and their certain areas of expertise and try and enlighten ourselves. This is slightly different, as this guy really brings nothing to the table except for that he signs the front of the checks. I'm mostly kidding. We're joined now by the publisher of the DailyCaller.com, Neil Patel. How are you doing, Neil?
Derek, how's it going, man?
It's going good. I haven't had to see you for a while. So, you know, anything that allows that to go on for a long time is pretty damn good, in my opinion. In addition, because it's not just that people are thinking, oh, you're just sucking up to the boss. No, it is that Neil actually has an expertise in policy. What was your job in the Bush administration?
I ran the policy team for the vice president. So I did do this for a living for a while.
Right. And everybody knows that that was where the real power was in the Bush administration. And it was all in Cheney's office. So I want to pick your brain about that experience working for the Bush administration, because you were working for the Bush administration during 9/11, which to this point, that point had been the sort of catastrophic moment that most people alive remember. Are there any parallels you can draw between that day, that time, and today?
You know, it was pretty different. You know, the nature of 9/11 and what we went through, I just think was so. The only parallels I'd say are both were obviously these huge events for our country that were extremely stressful and involved, you know, really heavy kinds of issues and people potentially currently obviously dying in large numbers. And 9/11, obviously, most of the death within our country happened right away. But there were a lot of questions, like sending troops overseas and kids who could die and things like that. And then,
and whether or not there were sleeper cells or more attacks planned. I mean, I imagine there was a lot of what's next, what's next.
There was a lot more of that from within the government than you realize from without, because there was all kinds of intel coming in that there were going to be these bio attacks and the airport attacks. And there were all kinds of times that we got really ramped up. And then realized that, you know, either it wasn't true or something else happened and got in the way of it. And so that was happening all the time within the government. So, yeah, there's some similarities, but I think it's also pretty different. You know, the government on the military side works a lot differently than it does on the civilian side. And 9/11, a lot of the issues that you had to deal with were mostly on the military side or the security side, at least, whereas this is sort of on the domestic civil side of our government. So that makes it a lot different too.
But I imagine after 9/11, you guys started, I mean, even before, but after 9/11 in particular, you had to start gaming out what could come next, not to just stop it, but also to deal with it, to handle it. Was there ever any discussion of something on this scale nationwide?
Well, we looked a lot at, you know, as we were standing up the Homeland Security office in the White House, we had a group actually within the VP's office that existed already looking at threats to America. And one of the big threats that we were looking at were the chemical and biological area. And we knew that the terrorists actually were interested and had done research in some of these areas. So we had a couple of amazing experts just on the VP's team on infectious disease and biological warfare. So and I remember at the time there was a famous smallpox war game, and it kind of, I mention it because this situation reminds me a little of that in a way, where in the war game, a terrorist released smallpox in a few American malls at a time, and it ended up, you know, spreading to the point where governors were putting up roadblocks, shooting people as they tried to enter their state from other states, things like, I mean, the country just fell apart really quickly. And luckily, we're not there, obviously, today. But you are seeing, you know, lots of these kinds of questions pop up where it's like, what is the authority of each governor, and how does our system all operate in this kind of an emergency? So yeah, there's some similarities.
How would you say the country is doing from somebody who at least wargamed possible scenarios?
I think people are confused. You know, I think we have a lot of people trying to do the best they can in a situation where we don't know a lot yet. So overall, I'd say the country's done pretty well. I think, you know, if you look at the politicians are mostly trying to do their best. You look at Andrew Cuomo in New York or Gavin Newsom in California and them dealing with Trump. And you see at least glimmers of times where, you know, they're putting a little bit of the partisanship aside and all trying to work together. And that's what I think all Americans want to see when we have emergencies like this. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. And then on an individual level, I think you're seeing a lot of generally good behavior, people helping each other when they can. I feel like I see more of my neighbors and my not that we're getting any close to each other, but, you know, everyone's around in the neighborhood in a way that you're not usually. So there are oddly, you know, as any time you have something horrible happen, there's some good sides to it. And I think we're seeing some of that.
No, there definitely is. There's always a silver lining. But when you talk about governors getting along with the president, that's undeniably true. They're pulling in the same direction. Yet it seems as though in Washington, much like after 9/11, there was a good period of time when people came together. It was a shock to the system. And I remember vividly that night, the members of Congress spontaneously singing God Bless America on the steps of the Capitol building. And they did put a united front forward for weeks, if not months. In this situation, are you shocked at all about how quickly or even if it went away, how quickly partisanship reemerged when it comes to legislation that is undeniably necessary, but to see Nancy Pelosi holding it up because she wants her considerations added in there. Are you shocked? Were you shocked when that happened right in the thick of this?
Not shocked. I mean, part of it I think is fine. I mean, we have different views on how to handle these things. And I think some of that comes from a perfectly good place where it's like each side thinks they legitimately, not in a partisan, I want to attack my opponent just for political reasons kind of way, but in a very legitimate way, like, you know, how do you best get money to people? Where do you best spend your money? Like, there are actual differences, and both sides are doing what they think is best, and they feel strongly about it. I don't have any
problem. How do you fund the Kennedy Center? Things important. Like that.
No, definitely, now, I look, that stuff, I think, was disgusting. And also, we're in an election year. Like, that's just a fact. We're going to have an election in November, which is crazy, given what we're dealing with, you know, right now and until then, probably. So that's, you know, it's not going away.
So you think the Trump administration is doing all right? If you were in there, and I know you're glad you're not in there. You're glad to be in the private sector. But if you were in there, is there something in particular they're doing where you would say you need to stop this or you need to do more of this?
I think they're doing pretty well, I guess, is my big picture answer. And I think actually, you know, there's a lot of debate about these press conferences the president does, and are they good or not, or smart or not, or politically where, you know, come out on that. I mean, I'm on the side that I think the more he communicates directly to the American people, the better. I think people actually like him more when they hear directly from him. When you hear about him through the media, you're getting a very different take. And so I don't think the government's been perfect. I do think the president was late to understand the seriousness of this. I know he closed the, you know, he stopped the flights from China. He did other things. But early on, I think he probably just didn't want to, you know, think this was coming in the way it was. And by the way, most of us shared that, and most Democrats did too. There's all quotes from them. So there's plenty of, you know, blame, if you want to call it that, to go around on that. But since then, I do think the president's done really well. I will say, you know, it's a complicated and quickly moving situation. So there's so much that we just don't understand about this virus still. We still don't really know the death rate because we still don't really know how many people have had it, right? So you don't, all you know is the rate of people dying versus those going in and getting tested. You don't know how many other people have had it. So we don't know the death rate yet. We don't really know how it's transmitted yet, which has a huge effect on what the government policy should be. In the beginning, if you remember, you had to have a touch from somebody, and that's why the 6-foot rule made sense. But now they're saying maybe it's aerosolized, meaning it can just be in the air. And so that changes your policy side of it. The models have been totally off. And this was part of what I wrote my piece about, Derek. So, you know, originally there were numbers of like being thrown around like 500,000 deaths in America. And then not very recently, it was 100,000 to 200,000. Now it's 60,000. And there's thoughts that it might go a lot lower than that. So once it starts getting there, you have to ask yourself, is shutting the whole country down worth it? And those are, you know, those are hard conversations to have, and it sounds cold because anyone dying obviously is horrible. It's tragic,
right,
for the people involved. But we actually accept death as a country. Obviously, we have to. We don't shut our country down. You know, there's all kinds of things that cause people to die that we could make go away if we were willing to take the kind of extreme measures that we're willing to take on this. So where is that line exactly? It does matter. It matters how many people are going to die. There's a difference between losing 20,000 and 200,000 people on the things you would do as a country.
And that really is, we're flying blind, and we're making policy based on projections, which is like making your retirement plans based on your lottery winnings in a lot of ways, because you don't know what's going to happen. It's a best guess about what's going forward. It's a lot like the climate change argument. The models say in 100 years, there will be this, there will be that. Well, you can't prove it per se, but more importantly, you can't disprove it. And that, I think, perverts how policymakers and advisors to the president, the vice president, act. You know, the best case scenario, something I wrote, the best case scenario is every politician comes out of this looking like they wildly overreacted, right? And that's a unique situation, because if you look like you wildly overreacted, that means that the totals are significantly lower than projected, which, you know, you can't really prove was because of your actions. So just from that perspective, this is a completely unique situation.
Yes, it's scary, because I agree with you completely. I think the politician's calculus is there's not a lot of downside to overreacting, and there's a huge political downside to underreacting. And, you know, this also comes down to, like a lot of things in America, our country is so divided among different groups of people as far as income and just sort of where the way the elites in America live versus regular people, that I think it's hard for everyone making these decisions right now. You would categorize as sort of an elite in America by income, by where they live, all those sort of ways we look at this stuff. And so for that group of people, what it means to like shut your economy down is you work remotely from home instead of going to work, because most of those jobs you can do remotely. And it means that you get to spend more time with your kids who are doing school at home. And it means that you're watching Netflix and the changes are not as extreme. If you're at the bottom end of our country economically, what this means is you've lost your job. You came into it with very little savings. The whole thing looks so different to you. And I do worry a little bit that in a world where everyone making the decisions is from that one group, that's not really actually in a day-to-day sense being crushed by this, it worries me. Do they see it? Can they feel how this can they sense how this feels for a regular American?
That's an important point. Everybody in a decision-making position has their job. The checks come in. They're government employees. There's no threat of those checks not coming in. Government never is the last one to ever take a cut. But they're making decisions for people out there who are hurting, for the truck drivers who are working and risking their lives, for the factory workers who are deemed non-essential, and now they're watching their business maybe not survive this. And they're sitting there waiting with bated breath, wondering not only when we come out of this, when we get the opportunity, the wink and the nod from Washington to go, okay, try it, go ahead, but also if there will be a business there for them to go back to. And that's what your piece was about. The coronavirus stage one is nearing an end. Does anyone know what comes next? Does anyone know what comes next? So we've never been here before. This is like Neil Armstrong talking in 1968 with authority about what it's like to walk on the moon.
So you asked me earlier, you know, is the government doing a good job? And again, I think they're good people and they're trying their best. And I think by and large, they've done okay. But the big but is the more I watch what's going on and think about it, like, I'm not exactly clear, and I should be because I read about this stuff all day. Why are we actually doing what we're doing right now as far as the level of mitigation we're doing? And I don't think it's been explained actually that well, because my big question about it is, what good will it have done once we stop? In other words, at some point, we're going to leave our houses. Mm-hmm. And unless we think we have totally wiped out the disease, which no one thinks, then it's just going to ramp back up again, isn't it? And at that point, what did we actually do? What did we actually gain by waiting all this time? And I know that, look, I don't know what the numbers would have looked like but for, but all I know about are their models, and their models have painted a very different picture than we're seeing. So if this is just going to ramp back up again when we leave our houses, you know, the first answer was, well, we have to bend the curve so the hospitals don't get overwhelmed.
Right.
But the
hospitals, that was the argument.
The hospitals haven't actually been that overwhelmed in most parts of the country.
And many are closing because they don't have other patients, and the coronavirus workload has been significantly lower than projected.
Right. The second part I would understand is if we develop some sort of immunity over time, because so many people were getting it, right, that they have antibodies, antibodies, and then over time they say you develop this sort of herd immunity once enough people have antibodies. I get that theory, but I don't think by any numbers that I've seen at all, we're at anywhere near a level where we're close to any kind of herd immunity, which means until we have a vaccine ready, which again is 18 months out at least around there, maybe 2 years even, what have we accomplished? It's just not clear to me. I know there are good people working on this, and it makes me wonder that maybe they don't really know. And they just saw this wave of death that might be coming, and they thought the only thing we know how to do in response to that is to get everyone in their house, which I get it. But then once they're in the house, which we are now, you got to start asking, what's the point of this strategy? Where does it end? And I think they're probably asking themselves that right now because they're not doing a good job of explaining it.
In the war games you did during the Bush administration and the reality of the Bush administration and the wars that we had, there are situations where there are no good options. There's just something you have to do. How do you measure the greater good, if you will, for lack of a better term, versus lives of individuals? Is there a mental scale? Is it just something you know? I mean, there are people whose job it is to make those decisions. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that you have to advise these people to make these decisions. What is the key when making that calculus?
Well, those are, you know, I think we make that calculus as a society all the time on, you know, what's the right speed limit, for example, right? If you know, how many people do we lose? I had the number recently. I don't have it offhand, Derek, but we lose a lot of people to car accidents every year. Everyone knows if we took that speed limit down to 5 miles an hour, we would lose virtually nobody. I mean, the bumpers are rated at 5 miles an hour, right? So, but it would also destroy a lot of our convenience and our economy and shipping and all kinds of things. So it's not something we're willing to do as a society. So we live with that level of loss of life. And it's just a sort of a decision we've made as a society. So, and there are actuaries and others who put numbers on lives. I don't know, you know, that's never been my part of my career. But these are decisions we're all making all the time. And that's why these models and the advice we're getting from the scientists is so important, because I think you and I or anyone reasonable would agree, look, if this thing would kill, you know, millions of Americans unless we all just shut our economy down, no matter how painful, we would shut it down. But on the other extreme, if it was going to kill 25 people and the choice was shutting our economy down for 2 years or killing, you know, having 25 people die, sadly, I mean, it sounds harsh, but as a society, we would not shut our economy down. So where are those numbers? We need that kind of, you know, that's the advice that you need to make those decisions.
How would you're a small business owner, it's a web-based business, so you're lucky in that sense that, you know, a shelter-in-place or stay-at-home order is not as disrupting. You got a bunch of people that you're no longer keeping an eye on, and you can't just summon and go out and visit at their desk, but you can call them, you can video chat them, you can email them, but it still has to impact business. As a small business owner who's been mildly impacted by this relative to places that are shuttered, what is your biggest fear for the longer that this goes on?
Well, I'll say we're lucky. Our business is probably one of the easiest to do remotely. And also people are home and they really want news about this. So our readership is way up. This is common to most news sites. Advertising is down. Obviously, a lot of the people who used to advertise, hotels, restaurants, et cetera, are not advertising right now. So the rates are all down. So we're about even as a business. Now there are other parts that are going to hurt our business. As you know, we bought a building for the Daily Caller, and we were going to use half of it and rent lease the other half to other companies. It's going to be harder to find tenants, undoubtedly, in this. So we're going to be hurt as a business in other ways. But if I look at other businesses, you know, travel and restaurants and others, they're decimated. And a bunch of them will not survive this at all. And that's just, you know, tragic, along with the loss of life, is that really affects people. And it's going to take us a while to come out of that. So yeah, as a business, the Daily Caller, I think, is actually super fortunate if you're, you know, putting those things on a scale. But more broadly, man, it is rough.
Looking at the Bush administration and the criticism that they got was on spending, that the spending went up. There was no attempt to rein in spending. Then the Obama administration came along, doubled the national debt in 8 years. And then the Trump administration came on. They certainly were not on a path to get spending under control in any way, shape, or form. But now we're looking at $6.5 trillion spent in the last couple of months, in the next couple of months, with another $1 to $2 trillion at least waiting in the wings. From just a responsible fiscal perspective, where do we go from here? What do we do? As a nation, when you rack up more debt than wealth you produce in the course of a year, that has detrimental effects on growth. I'm not saying the spending now isn't necessary. It certainly is. But the irresponsibility of the past has come back to haunt us. It would have been nice if we'd had our credit card balances paid off at a time when you have an emergency and need your credit card. Is there ever going to be an appetite, you think, for getting our fiscal house in order, or are we just going to have to learn to balance massive debt?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think for many administrations in a row, starting with the one I worked in, I personally think our spending record was horrible. There were some people inside, and I'm proud to be one of them, who's arguing that from the inside back then. I think during the Obama years, you saw Republicans screaming about spending at some points, but not accomplishing a ton. And then once the Republicans had control of the government again, they spent even worse or as bad as Obama was. So the record, there's plenty of blame to go around for pretty much everybody. Donald Trump, anyone who looked at the campaign knew that he was not going to be somebody whose goal it was to get spending under control. And to me, when I was weighing Trump versus Hillary, one of the things I looked at was like they were both going to be horrible on spending. I think that's come true. So we went into this in a bad place. If I looked at our long-term liabilities as a country and where, you know, I thought the next emergency was going to come from for a long-term, it was going to be on a spending crisis that we were going to walk into at some point. I think this is just pulling the date closer. It's not going to be dealt with until we get to the crisis now. I think it's almost, it's sad to say that, but you know, the view used to be back when we were in government was, and I will say, you know, George Bush deserved a little credit for it. He tried to do the Social Security reform thing, which was a big part of our spending. But back then when that didn't work, you know, people who looked at this said, we need to get a little closer to the problem. When the problem is closer to our doorstep, people on all sides reasonable people will get together and solve it. But actually, we already passed that point a few years ago, in my opinion, and we're no closer. In fact, we're probably farther away from solving it. Now you get all the new spending you just talked about on top of it, and the date just comes closer. So it was 30 years out before, it's probably 20 now. I mean, it's not that far off. And we will pass to our kids and grandkids the biggest catastrophe that any generation has passed to a next. And I don't see a way around it, sadly. And that will look like Greece at that point. Now, we're different. We're the world's reserve currency. We're the biggest economy. Hopefully we have some tools that we can use to get through that. But it's the easy solutions all required many decades to implement. Because, you know, you tweak the numbers a little bit over enough time and hopefully you make things look better. But we're too close to that.
Yeah, no, it's much easier to steer away from an iceberg when it's miles out
than
when it's on you. Looking at this from a political standpoint, when the government does reopen, if President Trump were to call up Neil Patel or Dick Cheney were to call up Neil Patel and say, you know, President Trump has asked me to advise him on restarting the economy, Neil, and I trust you on this. How would you go about it? Would it be everybody with a toe in the water? Would it be, okay, the Dakotas, you can go, and Tennessee, you can go, based on state numbers, and just heavily watch and monitor certain types of industries? Where do you start, and how do you prioritize the restarting of something as huge as a $25 trillion economy?
Well, I guess the big thing on that is in our system, it's really the governors who are going to make those calls. So you get guidance from the federal government, but Donald Trump hasn't closed anything, right? It's been the governors, and they're the ones who are going to reopen things. So I do think it makes sense, obviously, by locality to have different rules. And rural places where people are already spread out and where they haven't had as much of a problem can probably have different rules than you're going to have in the inner city. And, you know, a lot of it depends on the numbers and how they look, as far as how many cases you have. A lot of it also depends on the science and can we get some of these things like antibody testing? If we can do that at a mass scale, then if people know they have the antibodies, they can go to work and they could even go to a sporting event, right? I mean, it's that would be a huge game changer. And apparently that part of it is not as far off. You know, you mentioned the vaccines 18 months out or so. The antibody testing is here today. It's just, can we ramp it up quickly enough? So there's a lot of factors at play. I think the big picture is it's going to be mostly the governor's call. I would say my worry, if I was advising the president, it jumps back to what we talked about earlier, Derek. There's going to be the politics of this are weird, where if you're the guy easing up, you're going to get blamed. And
right. Any death, you're going to get blamed for.
Any death. And so Donald Trump wants to get our economy going. I think the Democrats are just waiting for him to do that. And as a political matter, you're going to be that much closer to the election. Some people will die and they'll say, see, Donald Trump got this, stopped the mitigation too soon and led to all these deaths. And now they're all on his shoulders. And that's the political side I'd be worried about. I still think, look, we're hurting people daily, every day we wait. So you got to do it smart. I don't think you just, you know, someone was talking about flipping the switch. I don't think anyone's saying you flip a switch. I don't think we'll be at a huge sporting event with 30,000 people in a hockey arena anytime soon, sadly. But hopefully we can have those games on TV at least. And hopefully more people can at least go to work and maybe work a little more spread out and take other steps. So it won't be immediate, and it mostly will be the governor's call, but I do hope it starts sometime soon.
Yeah, well, in Korea, South Korea, the baseball has returned to empty stadiums, but, you know, there is sports happening, so there is light at the end of that tunnel. Is there somebody in particular you'd like to see on the president's – he's supposed to announce the council tomorrow, Tuesday, which is today when people are hearing this. Is there somebody you would feel – you would go, oh, good, he's listening to them on this?
You know what's funny? And because I would never compliment him to his face. And he would never do this because it goes against everything he believes in. But you know who's been ahead of the curve on this from the start is Tucker Carlson.
I've heard of him.
I remember, back over the holidays, he was telling me, and he was saying it on his show, people need to look at this virus that's going on in China is really serious, and it could end up over here. And he was the first guy calling the alarm. And I actually back then said, this is just about ratings, like you're a typical TV guy who's just trying to stir the pot. And look, it turned out to be true. And since we've been doing this level of mitigation, he's one of the first guys to say, wait a minute, does this really make sense? Are we just delaying the inevitable? Are we hurting more people than we're helping as far as on all the people who are losing their jobs? So he would never join any council at all. But I hate complimenting him in any way possible. But because as my buddy, like it's my job to make fun of him, which is, you know, my general role with him. But he's been ahead this whole time. I don't know who else. I think the president has good advisors around him. He definitely needs some people from business, but not as much Wall Street as just people operating businesses around the country.
Let's talk about Tucker for a second, since people don't know. They know that Tucker was associated with the website. You two founded it together. I was the very first person you guys hired, suckers, back in the day, before we even had a name. And I talked you out of a couple of bad names for the website, so I'll take that legacy any day. But you've known Tucker since high school.
Since college.
College. You're probably as mature as high schoolers back in college.
Yeah, maybe junior high. I don't know. Yeah, we weren't very mature.
So how do you end up going into business with him 20, 30 years later?
Yeah, we never thought we'd do that. We've been friends, you know, since then, college, and godparents, each other's kids. And, you know, we moved to D.C. together. We used to commute to work together from our houses, which were close together. So never, ever imagined working together. I went into...
It's a risk because you could end up, you know, running a business together is different than hanging out with somebody. Put stress on friendship.
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely different from, you know.
You're a difficult person to be around. You're a difficult person to be.
I think you mean he is, right?
Well, you're both difficult for different reasons.
I you know what? It worked. We were fine. We're still friends, put it that way. And they always say don't go doing business with your friends. And it definitely... You got to, you know, you got to manage it, but it worked for us. And he is exactly the same guy that he was in college. And although I never imagined going into business with him, it's been a great thing. And I would do it. I'd do it again if it came around to it. And that is a rare thing. I think I can see all the reasons why you shouldn't go into business with a friend, but for us, somehow it worked out.
No, well, you guys have very different personalities, but they mesh well. Tucker is the easygoing guy, and you're the muscle that he brings in. You're the management, you're the business sense, and he's the visionary. All of those things sometimes occur in one person, and you guys click together like a couple of puzzle pieces. And I got to say that you work together well I'm sure you had your spats behind closed doors, just like everybody's parents argued when the kids weren't around. But at least from having seen it at the time when it was very stressful, when this thing was, you know, my God, are we going to even be able to launch? Are we ever going to be able to pull this together? You guys complimented each other well. Are you surprised at how well it went?
Yeah, you know, you never know. It was an idea on a piece of paper, and we launched it, and we had no clue what we were doing. Well, you know that better than anybody. Yeah. We had no idea what we were doing at all, and we kind of cobbled it all together and started this website, and it started to grow, and it is surprising. And I remember the first day, like, we got a Matt Drudge link to us for the first time ever a couple of months after we started, and the whole website crashed. It's, you know, because we had no idea what we were doing. So it's been a wild run since then. And we're 10 years in now. And, you know, we have millions of readers and 100 employees or so. So it's been extremely fulfilling, and it's gone great.
On a personal level, how are you and the family dealing with this? You're a guy, you love to go out to Wyoming. You love to be out in nature. You're a skier. You're just you're not a stay-at-home body kind of guy necessarily, but now you got to stay at home, and you're a I want to be doing something kind of guy, and now you can't really do all that much, and you've got teenagers, which on top of all of that has got to be pulling your hair out, what hair you have left. How is the family dealing with this?
Honestly, I think we've been fine and better than most. You know, I mentioned it's easy for us to, for me to work at home. A, B, my kids are, you know, as you said, teens. My oldest is going to be gone next year, go to college. We have a close family, and I've been telling our kids, like, look, this is kind of crazy. We're spending a lot of time together, and I get it. We're going to get on each other's nerves, but we'll never all live, probably never all live under the same roof together for as long as we are right now, ever again. So, you know, think of that side of it. But yeah, it's like every week that goes by adds, it makes it a little weirder, and people get on each other's nerves, of course. But by and large, I think we've done fine through it. I do think, you know, it'd be nice for it to end soon, but I think it probably will.
No, I think it definitely will too. But as we wrap it up here, Neil, how the word, the phrase return to normal is tossed around pretty cavalierly without really much thought, because, you know, this is abnormal and we just think of whatever it used to be as normal. I don't think it ever will be. As we sort of get the all clear, whenever that comes, in 3 weeks, in 3 months, whatever, how will you have changed? Well, you know, you get the all clear. I know you'll eat at a restaurant again. I know I can probably name the restaurants you're itching to go to, but are you going, when it's open again, by the way, your favorite, one of your favorite restaurants, you can go and get their food. You can cook it at home. They have it all prepared for you. They've become like a supermarket. It's kind of weird and testament to the innovation in the U.S. But how
soon is that?
The Palm.
Oh, really? You can go get everything?
Yeah, they're selling their beef, and they're selling their cuts of steak and everything, and they're selling they're even selling drinks, drink kits.
Oh, man.
You just cook it at home. I've been tempted. But how long after you get the all clear are you and the wife going to go, you know what, let's go out to dinner. Let's go out and see what's going on. Or is it, we could go, they're open, but I'm going to let somebody else go in the pool and tell me if the water's cold or not for a while.
I think we'll jump in, probably. I think I'll wash my hands a lot and do other stuff, but I've always been kind of a germaphobe, so that won't end. But I think we'll go. I do think, look, if you look at the number, it's the weird, this virus is so weird, right? Because it's clearly, like, highly contagious in the sense that people get. And I think in the beginning when they thought you had to touch someone and all that, they're finding out that's not the case. And it's so deadly in the sense that if you get the bad version, right, where, you know, where you start losing your breath and your lungs fill up and all that, it is like, it is really bad and really fast. You can go quick. The same time, I've spent a bunch of time looking at the numbers, that have been pretty small. And if you look by age, they've been really small, for anyone outside of the, you know, 80 plus or 70 plus. So I do think we'll go. I think the restaurants will space the tables out, and you know there'll be other precautions taken. But I think I go. I feel, first of all, I just feel bad for these guys. Like, people have lost their jobs and their businesses. So I will do my part. I've already done it with the takeout world to try to spend a little money when I can. So I think we'll be out there. But it is freaky. I don't think I'm a sports nut like you are. I don't know when the next time I'll be sitting in a packed stadium next to, especially an indoor stadium, next to somebody who I don't know for 3 hours. You know, that actually does seem a little weird to me.
Right. No, it's maybe the Daily Caller will have to get a suite then, rather than season tickets for the Caps.
You need to sell some more ads first.
Just throwing that out there. Neil, last thing, any words of wisdom for people out there who are concerned and you know, the small business owner who doesn't know if they're going to be able to reopen? There are a lot of programs to help. You've been both on both sides of it. You've been in government and out of government in the small business sector. So you've seen a lot more than somebody who just started up their dream bakery or something last year. And now they're sitting there wondering, is it even worth it to try and save it?
Yeah, look, I think we'll come out of this in the long run, and I think we'll be fine as a country and get right back on track. The question is, can people bridge the period from now until then? And I do think that the government's trying their best to put in place programs to do that. I think a lot of it matters on how long this all takes. And I think it is important for all of us. I don't have a ton of advice in that area that you can't get from people who are better than me at that. But I will say, you know, we haven't been challenged. The pockets of us have, like military families certainly have been challenged. You know, those who have any member of their family joining our volunteer military in the last couple decades, you know, have been over and over sent on overseas tours, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole country hasn't been challenged in this way in a long time, I don't think. Even 9/11, you know, if you didn't live in New York City or in D.C., your specific, or, you know, Pennsylvania, your specific community wasn't challenged in the direct way that we're challenged right now. So I think it's like actually a pretty great opportunity for our country. Like, can we be good citizens? Can we be good neighbors? Can we help each other? And you're seeing a bunch of that. And so there's all these new charities that are starting up, and there's all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, the other part of all this is, like, not to get heavy, but, like, you know, can we get something out of this? Can we improve as a society? Can we treat each other better and all that? I think it's an unbelievable opportunity. The old people, the last thing I'll leave with, you know, even as we start back up, there is a portion of our population where this disease is, like, flat out really scary. And some of those people don't have friends and family around them. And some of them could have been self-sufficient before this virus, in the sense that they could go to the store and get around, and now they can't. And if you don't have friends and family around, you're going to need help. This is another thing. I'm sure someone in the government's thinking about this, but they haven't been talking about it. And I've had our reporters go ask all these agencies, and no one's answering us. But what is the plan? There has to be, hopefully most of it's charitable, but the government's probably going to have some role. But, like, this is something we can all look inwardly and say, can we do something to help? And those kinds of things, I think, are good for a country, good for all of us. So, you know, that's the upside, I guess.
And hopefully we all come out of this slightly better people. Neil, I got to say, when I talked to you yesterday, you told me you went on a bike ride. And after we set this time up, I went and I pulled the bike out of the shed, filled up the tires, were surprised they weren't dry rotted, went for a bike ride. I didn't realize how hilly my neighborhood is. By the time I was done, about a half an hour later, I could barely walk. My legs were jelly. It was pathetic, but I think I'm going to climb back on that bike. So, you know, maybe not a lot of good that you've caused in this, but at least you've gotten me back on a bike. It's small.
Hey, you know, Derek, I've caused more good than you know. I was thinking today, like, if I can Derek live on his podcast, that wouldn't that be a kind of podcast history? And I've refrained. So I've done more good than you think.
Go for it. Go for it. Knock yourself out, asshole.
Anyway. We'd have the same effect, by the way. We'd go so viral if you just quit on me right here.
You'd be so bored without me showing up and bothering you at work. Anyway, Neil Patel, publisher of The Daily Call. I can edit all of you out, by the way. I can make you look horrible. I've got like 12 hours to do it. Neil Patel, Daily Caller, publisher, co-founder. Oh, I can't wait till I can see you again and annoy you in person.
Ah, man, I'm counting the days, Derek. Thanks, man.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for listening, tuning in, telling a friend, sharing on social media, and all that good stuff. Be safe. Be back here tomorrow. See you then.
Everything I do is voluntarily. Please, don't even imply that.